Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to the Sheerlux Book Club podcast with Georgina Blasky and Heather Steele. Today we're joined by a very special guest, the author and journalist Bryony Gordon. Bryony, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for having me. We're really excited to hear all your thoughts on this month's book. And at the end of the podcast, we'll be discussing your latest release, Mad Woman. But first up, Tom Lake by Anne Pratchett. In this podcast, the three of us will be diving deep into the novel and discussing some of the comments left by book club members on the Sheerlux community. So let's dive in and let's assume it goes without saying, spoilers alert.
Spoiler alert.
Sound the klaxons.
Have either of you read the book?
No. Shit. Don't give us any spoilers.
Especially then for like a week, a month. What am I talking about?
And
an hour.
Who?
Yeah.
Sorry, what? I thought we were here to talk about the weather.
First of all, can you not disrupt the class, please? It's a very serious conversation.
I'm putting my feet up now.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Let's start again. I'm joking. Cool, okay.
Has anyone read any Anne Pratchett books before? Bryony. Let's come to you.
I have read an Anne Pratchett book before. I read Bel Canto. I really loved it.
I really hated it.
Yeah. What? We see that I loved Bel Canto. And I also read The Dutch House, which came out about 4 or 5 years ago, and loved that as well. But then Georgina was like, I really disliked Bel Canto.
I loved it.
It
was, I found it like quite like, ooh, it was kind of a thriller, but also quite fun. I mean, she's very funny.
For anyone who hasn't read it, Georgina, do you want to give us your quick summary, given that
I didn't love the plot and I didn't love any of the characters. So for me, I just didn't love it. I have an outside of work book club and they said, why don't we read this book? And I was like, hang on, who's that author again? Not realising actually how kind of amazing and, you know, her reputation and all the rest of it. And I just said, oh, no, I don't want to read anything by her ever again. And thank God they said, we don't agree with you.
Yeah.
This is what we're reading. This to me was like a complete, like reading a different book by a different author. But that's just me.
But Bel Canto is about like a hostage situation.
Yeah. In an opera house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In South America somewhere?
Yeah.
I seem to remember. I do forget plot intricacies almost as soon as I finish a book, because I read quite a lot of books. But I just remember thinking it was fascinating.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting how you started to see all the different, you know, all the different sides of the people who, you know, the people who have been taken hostage, but also the hostage takers.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, didn't love it. But you read The Dutch House, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I loved The Dutch House. That was amazing. That's about two siblings whose parents have died and they've been left this amazing old house. But it sounds very basic when you explain it. The sort of evil stepmother then sort of takes the house and they're not allowed it and they're sort of thrown into poverty, which sounds quite sort of fairy tale like. But it's actually set over sort of 5 decades and it's about their relationship and then looking back to the past about the relationships they have with their parents, and there's much more to it than just trying to get a house back, let's just say. I thought it was excellent. I just think she writes people and relationships really, really well.
Well, hold that thought.
I thought that was good for this one too.
So she's got a good number of novels under her belt, and
she's a legend.
She's applauded for them.
And so yeah, last year she received the National Humanities Medal from the White House, which they say she received for putting into words the beauty, pain, and complexity of human nature. So based on the previous books we've just been discussing, and this book's sort of central plot line being largely set in the pandemic, we can see why that sort of human nature and complexity, how that sort of works. How did you both feel reading a sort of pandemic-based book a few years on?
I really enjoyed it. I loved it. I didn't really know what to expect of it, and I didn't see it going as it did. You know, I like that sort of, because yeah. The pandemic's, you know, it's quite a long time ago now.
Yeah, nearly 4 years ago.
And I like that making sense of how we, you know, of that very very strange time. But it's not really about the pandemic.
No,
it's about a family thrown together during the pandemic. And I really loved it. I just think she's such a funny writer as well. Like, there were bits, you know, she's obviously not a comedic,
no,
a comedy writer, but there were just little bits that just made me actually laugh out loud. Like when one of the daughters is finally told that she's going to get married, and her husband to be starts talking to her dad, and they're like, the daughters are like, "Are you arranging her dowry?"
Yes.
But the way it was just, I mean, it's just, there are, it's, I really loved all that little stuff of the daughters interjecting as mum tells her story and telling her off because she can't use that word, she'd get cancelled.
Yes.
There were like lots of sort of like generational crossovers, which I thought were done really beautifully.
Yeah. I like that as well. Like you say, sometimes you'd just be reading a passage and it could be about anything, and there'd just be like a sort of tiny sentence slipped in that was maybe about 10 words long, but it would just be so funny, or like an amazing observation, and then you'd move on, but you'd just be like, oh yeah, that was just a really funny, clever little bit of writing.
I love it when a book, either you're on your Kindle and you highlight it because you want to remember, or you kind of like mark the page because it says something that you want to keep. And I have that. I have like a little collection of bits from books that have made me kind of gasp and have landed in my heart. And there was one bit where the protagonist, Lara is talking about her, I mean, she's now a farmer, but she was talking about her like previous career as an actress and in LA, and you know, she was quite successful or on the path to success. And she talks about how she always thought that her career had floundered because she wasn't good enough, but she realized as she got older that actually it was because she wasn't brave enough. And that really, really, like,
it hits me
because it's so true. And it was such a kind of, you know, I think as women as well, it's so easy to think you're not good enough at something, and to sort of go, okay, and to get into terror and overwhelm and imposter syndrome, which is like a phrase that has just been created, I think, to kind of put us down as women, you know. And actually it's the kind of fighting through that bit and accepting that. Someone said the other day to me, like, life is full of roses and life is full of thorns, and it's about how you handle the thorns, you know. And as women, I sort of have this notion that if I encounter a thorn, I'm doing something wrong, you know, so I should stop. It's not, you know, it's, and I think that really landed with me.
So the story is sort of essentially told along two timelines. So there's the one where Lara's sitting down with her three daughters and telling them her story about her old life as an actress and the romance she shared with a now famous actor. But then there's the second sort of timeline where she's, now a mother of three in 2020. So yeah, I was just wondering how you both thought Lara's storytelling sort of impacted her relationship with her daughters, and how those shared memories influence their perceptions of each other.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting how, going back to what you were just saying, Bryony, about like the daughter saying, oh, you can't say that, or you would, you know, calling her out on either the language she'd used or, you know, way she'd express something. And I just think it's quite interesting how the daughters had their version of how they remembered their mother's life.
Yeah.
And they were really strong on that. And they even corrected her, like, oh no, you weren't there then. And she's like, no, I did. I went to New Hampshire and then I went to New York.
Yeah, yeah.
But before that, I'd been in LA. Like, she was really... Yeah. And they were kind of remembering her history their way from snippets they'd obviously picked up along the way. And then having this moment in the pandemic to be together and to revisit this whole part of her life and to tell them her version, slightly modified at times, I think,
well,
of events.
That was interesting in itself. Yeah. What she chooses to tell them and what she chooses to leave out, because I think very much there was a stage in sort of parenting, and certainly when I was a child in the 80s and the 90s, where parents were like, you know, you need to be like their best friend, you need to be their friend, and you know, you need to let them feel they can tell you everything, which sometimes involved telling your child everything. And I actually think it made me think about this, about the boundaries you put down. Like, there are some things you just should not ever tell your children, you know, and it doesn't matter how old they are. It's yeah. like that is a that relationship between parents and children psychologically is a really important one that forms a sort of quite safe, it's a safe psychological thing in your life.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important that you don't know that your, you know, your mum ended up being impregnated and having in a rehab unit.
And then
it's not just very formal, they're impregnated and having an abortion. I mean, I'm not saying that these are bad things.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that I think it's really important for us also as humans to have things we don't talk to everyone
yeah.
about. And maybe it's not out of shame. It's out of like, I don't think that's a necessary thing for me to have to share with
yeah.
you.
Yeah. I mean, I've got, I have teenagers and I have quite sort of firm boundaries around that. Like, I'm, as I think I've touched on before in a parenting podcast, like, I'm happy to talk to you about sex, but I'm not talking to you about my sex
life
or my previous sexual experiences.
Yes.
But we can talk about sex and pornography and all the other things.
Yeah.
And I feel like Lara takes that view
yeah.
that there are things that she's willing to share, but not everything has to be laid out. And there's sort of, she's protecting herself and them by doing it that way.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that she's necessarily presenting this like glossy, amazing version of her life, because she still, you know, touches on things that definitely did not go to plan.
Yeah.
And you get that sense of the betrayals that she experienced as a young woman from people close to her. What we had discussed yesterday, Heather, about that kind of abandonment by her
yeah.
own parents,
yeah,
it feels,
yeah.
and sort of being brought up by her grandmother, and the sort of ramifications of that, and things, you know, that obviously maybe she was then put in a situation as a result of that. It's interesting to think about how she it is her history, and she's quite protective that her children don't just get to retell it their way. And obviously the way that her children then react to her telling it reveals a lot about each of those daughters as well.
Yes.
And what they're holding on to and what they want from their mother and the version of events they want to believe is their backstory as well.
I suppose along those lines, so somebody on our book club community left a question and a comment saying, through their relationship with their parents at this time, we learn a lot about Lara and Joe's daughters, Emily, Maisie and Nell. Was there any one daughter you identified with most, and did that change as the plot developed? Seems a good time to bring that in.
I definitely identified with Emily's sort of teenage histrionics.
Yes.
Like, maybe Peter Duke's my actual dad, you know, like that.
Yeah.
I definitely had a moment as a teenager where, you know, the hormones are pumping and everything feels very intense and dramatic. And I felt very other. And I was like, maybe it's because these aren't my real parents.
Yeah.
Maybe I was left on their doorstep. You know what I mean? Like, but you know that sort of sense of trauma that comes in. Yeah.
I remember having this, I think once like my parents had had a row, nothing major, they're still very happily married. And I was almost sitting up in my bedroom, like in my mid-teens, thinking to myself, it might just be really cool if they got divorced. Like, I just need some teenage, proper teenage drama and angst going on
here.
Yeah. And it almost feels of that ilk, like, come on, let's just throw it all up in the air.
Yeah.
Let's just see if the worst happened, what would that be like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like Emily is that person.
Yes.
At that point in her life.
Yeah.
Not so much, obviously, later when we're in story lane two.
Yes. I thought that was interesting, though, that, because also, obviously, she has this idea that Duke's her father. And they've both got the long black hair. They're the only ones with the black hair, I think. So she's kind of really latching on to that idea. But then, again, spoiler alert, we'll probably discuss it later. But the fact that you then realise that she had actually met him when she was four. And yeah, and then you're like, oh, well, maybe there was just this tiny... She doesn't remember that, but there was just this tiny part of her that had remembered meeting this man with dark hair, didn't put two and two together, but kind of sparked something.
And I found that whole idea of Emily thinking Peter Duke was her dad completely far-fetched and slightly ridiculous, obviously forgetting my own teenage brain. Right now, of course, it makes perfect sense. But I did then, as we got to the end of the novel and you find out she had actually been pregnant by him, suddenly I was like, oh, that's really interesting, because now I feel like Emily had this sixth sense about something.
Yeah.
And maybe, like you say, she had this memory, which is lodged somewhere that she doesn't remember, but sort of so buried deep in your subconscious. Yeah.
But I think also kids are kind of sponges, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? And I think there's also, that's a really interesting thing to explore, is like, you think you can keep things from them, but actually, even if they don't, if they're not picking up, even if they don't know exactly what happened, they will pick up and absorb your kind of vibe. And maybe that is what that kind of sixth sense is.
And you said that yesterday, actually, Georgina, when we were coming up with the questions, that you were like, maybe when Emily was 14 and having all the, you know, shouting out and being like, he's my dad, this, maybe Lara accidentally sort of reacted in a certain way, or her face was just kind of revealing more than she, remembers at the time because of the pregnancy that she had.
Yeah.
Before with Duke. Like, maybe that sort it of was revealed giving something to Emily that she latched onto.
Yeah.
There's also this kind of theory in psychotherapy of, like, and I hear it all the time when I'm listening to, like, very woo-woo kind of podcasts or whatever, where, like, whatever you don't deal with, you're, like, psychologically in your life, your children, what you will pass down and your children will end up dealing with.
I think so. And I feel like that is so much about what this book does explore. Mm. How often do you sit down with your parents and say, I would like for you to tell me chronologically about all the sort of real milestones and things in your life? And that's why obviously the daughters had built their own picture of what they thought their mother's life was. And I just thought that it's really interesting how their questioning is the questions that they want to know the answers to, as opposed to the things. And the things they pick holes in are the things that they're more interested in and want to kind of poke their finger in deeper.
And I think there's a line as well, is that where Lara's like basically telling them to shut up. Like, you wanted to hear the story, so you have to listen to these bits that you think are the boring bits, even though you want to know the really gory details.
You just
want
to get straight
because,
to them.
Because, if you don't understand these other bits I'm trying to tell you, you're not going to understand the full picture.
Yeah, which is a really nice way, obviously, for us as readers to get all the backstory. Talking of kind of the backstory, I think Lara is a young woman. While she's clearly independent, she also appears, especially when she's much younger, to be very impressionable. She gets swept into relationships. I'm thinking about with the first, well, Jimmy.
Jimmy George.
Jimmy George, the maths teacher from two towns over, who obviously is grooming her. There's smoking, sex, acting, moving away to LA at a young age on her own, quitting college, then moving on to the farm with Joe. Equally, it would be fair to say she ends up in strange situations as a young girl because of her lack of parental guidance. Was she old before her time? And how do the adults that come into her life influence her?
Oh, that's a big question.
It's a big question, isn't it? I mean, I think it's just really interesting how, well, I can't imagine being a child of the 90s in that sort of teenager time. My parents going, yeah, you go to LA, give it your best shot. We'll see you when we see you.
So we assume, aren't we, that we know that she was in LA and doing this thing in the mid to late 80s. I find that all fascinating as well, and that sort of also that not really realizing that those things, what that really reminded me of, those opportunities that we experience and when we're young and we just don't have any clue as to how amazing they are. Do you know what I mean? We just sort of go, oh yeah, sure, I'll go along with it, and then later we go, in a way, later go, oh my god, I can't believe I didn't see, you know, the opportunity I was being given. And that sort of hindsight you can get, where because we can be so down on ourselves and so awkward about ourselves, we kind of, I guess it's that imposter syndrome, so it comes in and you don't actually kind of make the most of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because there are times when she's at Tom Lake and Ripley, believe it or not, still trying to get her to come back to promote the film and do other acting jobs, and she's just not interested by that stage, is she? But perhaps if she'd have, like you say, thought about, actually, this is now is the time, if I want to make a career of it, I need to be back in LA and doing all these things and making the most of the opportunities while I have them.
But also that sense of, as women, going with, you know, not having that sense, strong sense of self, which I, you know, I totally relate to, where I, you know, it's only really in my 40s that I've gone, actually, I'm going to do things my way. Mm-hmm. I've had the strength, you know, to kind of go, and I've always done what other people have wanted from me, you know, but I've never necessarily done what I've wanted. And I've gone and done things that I didn't, you know, because I'm like, oh, they must know better than me about what's good for me.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Well, and I think she is definitely guilty of that. Yeah. Not guilty. Signed up to that.
Yeah.
Because even when she's sort of, I think she says like her grandmother had made her the one piece, and then the wardrobe girl is like, take the two piece.
Yeah.
And it felt really daring that she was going to wear a bikini and not a swimsuit, which is why, in my mind, I felt like it wasn't necessary. It didn't feel to me like an 80s/90s situation. I felt like it was more of a 40s or 50s. And I had to keep reminding myself, hang on, this is actually set way more recently than I felt. Like, I had this image of her arriving.
The 80s, this is where we make the mistake. The 80s is not that recent.
In my mind, it was yesterday. Okay, I'm sticking with that.
Well, that just was like last decade.
It's
like,
I always think the 80s was 20 years ago, and it wasn't.
Oh, no. Gutting. That is a gutting fact.
No, I can tell you for a fact, because I was born in 1980, and I will be 44 this year.
So, well, to me, I still think 20 years ago.
But I had this idea of her, like, arriving at LA airport, and, like, the limousine comes to pick her up. And I've kind of got this whole, you know, that Leonardo DiCaprio, Catch Me If You Can airport, where he's always walking through with all the air hostesses and all the beautiful cars. And, like, that's what I pictured. And we said, like, Tom Lake, we thought, felt like the Dirty Dancing hotel with the lake.
The idea of Tom Lake. I was like, I want to be in Tom Lake.
Yeah.
And I get why she got swept along with all these things, because I was lying in bed reading, you know, the sort of Seduction from Peter Duke. And I was like, blood.
Yeah.
I was going, oh,
I know.
And I was like, this is a bit tragic, Bronnie. You're a 43-year-old woman. But I felt like she's very good at writing those, those characters. Mm. And it reminded me, the only other time I've read a book where I've kind of gone, ha, and swooned like that was American Wife by Curtis Sinford.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I love that book.
That sort of, like, relationship when they're getting together. And I was like, oh, my God. And I really felt quite, like, I was very attracted to Peter Duke.
Yes.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, she had taken up smoking and was on her way to getting cystitis within about 4 hours
exactly.
of arriving in
so true.
Dreamy
and
place.
And I just wanted to be, just wanted to be smoking cigarettes and drinking beer on the lawn looking at Tom Lake with Peter Duke.
Yeah, so true.
But let's just take a moment, guys.
On this cold grey the February day.
Yeah.
Take a moment to transport ourselves there.
So at the start of the story, Lara doesn't even want to become an actress. I think, again, it goes back to that sort of impressionable stuff. She's just there because it's a Saturday and she's been roped into sort of taking names with her best friend by her grandma. But she sort of learns how to act by watching people and then basically doing the exact opposite.
Watching people who can't act.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, learn by not doing, I suppose. But later on, she feels like she's a great actress. She believes that she's a great actress, but only in that one role. So how much do you think sort of luck and timing plays a part in the book in terms of her career as an actress?
Well, I think it's luck and timing is what, you know, it's not just in the book, it's in...
In life.
In life, isn't it, you know? But I love that sort of remarkable chance things that can change the kind of the trajectory of our lives. I that's sort of magic, don't you think?
Yeah, it's magic, but then it's also kind of so true.
There will be something that, you know, we will do today that will change the trajectory. You know, like every day we do little
because
things.
Because I met you on a press trip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why you're sat here now.
Exactly.
And who knows where that might lead us in a year's time.
I also think to myself about, like, all, and, you know, in just in terms of, like, personal stuff in my life and horrible things I've been through and, you know, and horrible experiences. And then I kind of, I go, yeah, but I wouldn't have, it's like I wouldn't have met my husband if I was talking the other day with my with someone about people that get married really young in their early 20s and they usually this is a massive generalization, but they always end up getting divorced, you know, in their late 30s. And I was thinking, I remember having this real hankering to be like, you know, married and settled in my 20s, and I wasn't, and I was in addiction and alcoholism and all sorts of other things. And, you know, and I can look back and go, oh, it's a shame that that was a decade of, but I'm really, you know, it led me to where I am and
yeah,
where I...
And you can't cherry pick the... No. I just want the good bits from my life, yeah. But unfortunately, yeah. You know, it doesn't work like that.
I think, yeah. You know, everyone's on their journey, yes. Or whatever.
But with the luck and timing, I think what's interesting is that it kind of took her down a path that maybe she wasn't really suited to. Yeah. So while she had success, it was obviously quite limited. And it got her to certain places, and it also gave us a great book, obviously. Yeah. But I feel like, would she have really kept going as long as she did in real life?
Yeah, you know, she would really much would, but that thing, that thing is like where she says, that key thing that really landed with me is like, I thought my career ended because I just wasn't good enough,
yeah.
You know, and like it was like the luck ran out, but actually she realizes it was because she wasn't brave enough,
yeah.
Because that's the reality,
yeah.
Like the people in life that succeed, they're not like, oh, everything I turn my hand to,
yeah. Yeah.
Turns to gold, do you know what I mean? They just go with the opportunities and they go with the flow, mm. And they don't get cowed or like knocked back by rejection, because we all encounter rejection,
yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that thing of like Peter trying to get her to have therapy, or am I misremembering?
Oh, is it Ripley? I think
Ripley,
that's her,
sorry.
Yeah. The creepy uncle figure, yeah. Who's I her mean, agent.
It, but there's,
yeah,
like lots, yeah. Of, you know, and she's just like, no. And I think that's the kind of, that's where she's talking, mm. About. Like, actually, she probably could have had a really, you know, amazing career,
well,
if she just,
yeah.
Pushed
and
through.
And Duke says that as well. When he does come to the farm, he was like, oh, I watched Singularity, and she can't believe he even watched it. And he was like, you were incredible.
Yeah.
But could she have had success if she basically kept playing the same character in the way that many well-known actors that we
no,
know
No, but also,
love,
but that was part of the thing. That's
like,
yeah.
Meg Ryan plays Meg Ryan.
Yeah, but that's part of, you know, her lack of self-esteem, yeah. Is that she thinks, I can only play Emily in Our Town. But it's like, actually, how do you know that?
Yeah.
How do you know that? If you don't, yeah. Try and you don't go out there and you don't, you know, like, I can get that with things. I think I'm just, it's a fluke that I'm good at this.
Yeah.
But, and so I'll just stay doing this for the rest of my life because I'm safe. I'm,
yeah,
safe,
yeah,
doing,
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
But who's to say that if you, you know, if you didn't go out and try something else, you might be even better at that and even more, yeah. Successful
it's
at that.
It's true, because she did try Fool for Love, which is a very different.
Well, that's where I'm
play.
Kind of coming from,
yeah.
That she tried that and she couldn't do it. But then obviously she was doing it under the most extraordinary circumstances of,
yeah.
We'll have a bottle of tequila every rehearsal.
And she's shagging the lead and there's too much.
And
going
they're already,
there.
That's beginning, yeah. To, well, he's clearly going down a different path, mm. And he's sort of beginning to have some kind of breakdown.
Yeah.
And she,
yeah.
Is. Unable to cope with that,
yeah, yeah,
fair enough, and isn't able to do those rehearsals and play that part in the way that she thought she would be able to do it so easily,
yeah,
because,
yeah.
The other one seemed to have come to her so,
yeah,
easily,
yeah.
I guess that's where I thought, oh, maybe you're not cut out for this.
No,
after,
but, yeah. Well,
maybe it was just the only other other thing she got to try was,
yeah.
Perhaps.
But also,
right, well,
maybe the,
yeah.
Only she's only the only reason she's like, we choose whether we're cut out for things or not.
Yeah,
do you know what,
yeah.
I mean? I mean, the very fact that she kind of gave up says, you know, but like she could have chosen to be like, okay, this is one of life's,
yeah,
thorns,
yeah.
And
yeah,
I've just got to get through it. You know, just because I do think there's that sense that if we're failure, you know, is seen as, or, you know, if everything, you know, there's that kind of sense of, as women, having to be perfect,
mm,
the whole,
yeah.
Time. And if we're not perfect at everything, then we shouldn't be doing it.
Mm.
You know, we should jack it in and go and do something else that we're better at, you know. And actually, it's a totally normal part of life, you know. And as you say, there were lots of other things going on in the,
yeah.
Background that contributed to that, you know. And it's like, we don't give up just because we've
fucked up at one thing. Yeah. You know, it has thing hasn't gone as well as the thing before. You know, I have to really remember that in my life, like, because I can go into this whole kind of fantasy of, oh, no, I was really successful then, and then but that year I wasn't, and that and that's because I was, you know, and I should just give up and just go back to the year 2017 when, you know, I was, and it's like, well, no, you have to just keep going and trying different things, but, you know, but you keep persevering.
Yeah, but I guess, but I'm not convinced that she was a fantastic actress, and I think I'm with her in her belief that she maybe wasn't cut out for it. But I don't. But so I would say she tried it, she had a go, and then decided to move on to something else that maybe she felt more comfortable in and was a world she wanted to be more part of. But I would say that also because she just had such a car crash at the end of Tom Lake. Mm. Well, literally. Not literally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She sort of...
Spoiler alert!
A wheelchair crash. And at that point, you sort of feel that was her signal that this was time to...
Well, there is something beautiful, isn't there, as well as going... You don't always have to do the shiny thing.
Exactly.
The shiny thing isn't always the kind of like the best thing.
Yeah.
And just because we think, oh, Hollywood, that must be good. Yeah. And you, I mean, you see how that turns out for
a lot of people,
you know, in the book. And actually, here she is. Like when they, when the four of them go to the farm for the, you know.
Yeah, I love that.
The cherry, and they're like blown. I mean, I wanted to go and see these cherry trees.
Yeah.
And that is like, oh my God, this is what we should be aspiring to. Not being like light, you know, lights, camera, action, name up in lights. It's like, oh, I could just stand here and stare at these cherry trees all day.
Yeah, and it's such an antidote, isn't it, to the life that they're all living at that time.
And I think she is genuinely happy with that life with Joe, with her daughters on the farm. And, you know, she says so many times, it's not easy. It's not easy being a farmer and everything else that comes with. And, it, you know, you can see throughout them cherry picking in a whole season. It's fucking hard work.
Far easier to be a Hollywood star than it is to be a cherry farmer.
Yeah, like it sounded exhausting, but she still seems happy. So I feel, maybe luck, timing, whatever it was, choosing a different path.
I would be happy.
Well. I'd be happy.
Oh, it sounded like heaven.
Yeah. Like even the description of them against all their neighbours' advice, like doing the kitchen extension after having that massive window, just so they could look.
No one has a big window in Michigan.
What are you doing? Just to look upon the orchard. I was like, that does sound idyllic.
Yeah, and I think it's that real the appreciation that she has for Joe's uncle and aunt and what they put into the farm, and then naming Maisie after after the aunt. And I think just talking a bit about names and identity, all the daughters' names and the meanings behind those names are revealed as we get through the novel, particularly towards the end. I think finally finding out that Nell is after her beloved grandma is really, really touching, so sweet. And I think it's lovely to have all those meanings behind the names, but also I thought how she uses names to reveal identity.
Oh, I loved... spoiler alert! I loved realising that Nelson was Joe.
I said like,
no way! Yeah,
you didn't see it coming.
No! I said this to Georgina.
Did you?
I sort of, just literally about three or four pages before it came, I was like, aha! No, I think I've worked something out.
I didn't. I had to read it twice because I was like, where's Joe entered the picture? Where was Joe? Yeah,
but she does just like slip it in. So, and you're like, what? But also, I love that because also it's like totally flips your expectations. Yeah. And I love any book that does that where you think, oh, this is a Joe. And now, and I love that. Oh, and Nelson is now a cherry farmer.
But like from... Like,
who gets the girl?
Exactly. But if you were to like lay the plot out like that, like, oh, and guess what, this director guy was actually her husband, you know, it might seem a bit like, oh, of course, but just the way
she does
wrote it and it was revealed, it was just so clever. And I didn't see it coming at all. I like shouted, I was on the sofa like,
here's a win for the little guy.
I was just like, what are you on about? I was like, there's a major reveal. I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, really, really good. I was listening to something, an interview with Anne Patchett, and she was saying her mum had said, I'm so desperate to read this book you've written, just print me out the manuscript and I just need to read it. And she started reading it and her first comment to her was, there are too many Emilys. I don't know, there's just too many Emilys. And again, when she goes to see Duke, when he is in the mental hospital and she gives her name.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we don't have a Laura Nelson down here. No, Laura Nelson, no.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, Emily Webb?
Yeah.
Emily Webb. Oh, yes, yes, you're down on the list. And there was so much of her identity wrapped up in this part of her life that was then... that, you know, he didn't really think of her as Lara. He thought of her as his co-star.
Emily.
And his birthday even girl, that she, quote he kept saying.
Yeah. And there was sort of a, that was really interesting how the kind of legacy of names that people had. And as a reader, you sort of brought that into how you related to those characters.
It's true.
Because suddenly, had it just been, oh, and then I married this guy called Joe the Cherry Farmer, you'd have been like, oh, Joe the Cherry Farmer. Yeah. You're like, oh my God, Joe, who was brought back into the theatre where they then reconnected, and she was like the seamstress.
Yeah.
To, and he was brought back in as like this emergency director because his reputation was that good.
Yeah.
And
yet
he still, his heart was, I just want to go and help out my uncle and aunt and take over the farm.
But also, her name is like, I mean, she's originally called Laura.
Laura, yeah.
Yeah.
And then at a young age, it's like...
I'll take the U out.
Yeah, I'm going to... This Lara Kennison sounds better than Laura, so I'm just going to make that decision right now. Actually, on the subject of Emily versus Lara, Joe calls her Emily. That scene you were just talking about when he is in New York and they sort of meet again, he's like, Emily, Emily? And she's just there, like, continuing, thinking he's talking to the person she's sort of working on because that's not her name. And then she eventually sort of turns around and realises he's talking to her. But even to Joe, she was Emily, not Lara.
Well, also it's clinging on to those identities, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because she talks so much about, you know, you start to sense her fear that she's going to be, one day she won't be Emily anymore.
Yeah,
she will
her
be too.
Fear is there, being one of the women in the queue, the older Emily. Yeah, so that whole actually, bit is excruciating.
There, but it's there from the sort of beginning, isn't it? And that sense that I suppose we all have, again, as women.
Yeah.
Like, oh God, eventually I'm going to be Mrs. Webb.
Yeah.
You know,
yes, exactly.
But also then that funny thing of like Peter Duke playing her dad and that being like totally far, you know, like men just get kind of...
ages around.
But I loved that as well, the way they were like, there was, I think she described like Peter was sort of like grabbing her ass, like, but the audience couldn't see when he's the dad and she's...
He's like kissing
her
on the forehead but with the most highly charged kiss on the forehead ever.
And they get told to rein it in
a bit. Nelson, like Joe, has to be like, that's great, can we just tone it down for the front seats. On the play Our Town, now's probably a good time to mention it because we're chatting about it, somebody on the community was like, Our Town is a central theme in the narrative. As an English reader, a British reader, I had never heard of this play. While its role still worked for me, I'd be interested to know more about its cultural significance in the US and the motivation for the author's choice of this play. I had to Google it about a quarter of the way through to be like, is Our Town a real play? Because I didn't know.
I assumed it is a real play.
It is.
But I didn't bother to Google it.
Well, I wasn't sure. I was like, it could be a real play or it could just be one that's been made up, you know, and sounds like it should be a real play. But Georgina, it is a real play and you studied it at school, right?
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news?
All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I didn't love it because it's so American. It's so, here's our town, we've got Main Street, we've got, and the stage manager, who's the narrator in the play, opens up the play, walks on. I mean, it's kind of like a sort of seminal piece of American playwriting.
Yeah.
It has huge affection for Americans, and it's kind of the play for every man.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't feel like it translates over to the sort of British mindset in quite the same way. So I found actually knowing the play and not loving it, having studied it at an age where I probably just didn't
wouldn't
really
have
get
ever appreciated
it, to be
it
fair.
Anyway.
Yeah. I just found it kind of annoying because I think I just remembered like play rehearsals doing it and thinking this play's really boring because I didn't get the nuances of it at that point. So I actually found it a little bit irritating. But by the time I got to the end and then I heard and talking about it, I thought, I'm being a bit harsh, because this is something very close and true to the American experience, and fair enough. I'll let her have that one.
Yeah,
she's always in a bit of King Lear as well, doesn't she?
Yes. I think we'll discuss it a bit later, but have you ever read A Thousand Acres by Jane Smiley?
No.
It's this amazing book that came out in the 90s. Again, I had to study it at A-level alongside King Lear, but it's essentially a sort of retelling of it, and it's about sort of, it's daughters on a farm, and it's about succession and, you know, a dad sort of trying to split up his land and what should they do with it. And I found it so similar to this in a really good way, that whole like what's gonna happen. Some of this book I think did feel like a play, not just the Our Town things.
Well, Reese Witherspoon snapped it up, surely, and she'll
turn it into something
like she normally does.
Book club, isn't it?
Yeah.
If she's got it as a book club, she must have all the production rights. Well, I feel like
played,
we say that.
Who would play Duke, though, if they did an
adaptation? Oh, God, George Clooney.
Yeah.
Well, I've got, I mean...
You have to have him as young, wouldn't you?
So the Audible is read by Meryl Streep.
Yes, which I thought was really clever.
Can I just say, like, I dream of the day that my publishers are like, oh, by the way, we've got Meryl Streep to narrate your audiobook. Don't worry, you don't have to go to that little studio in Soho.
And read it.
Yeah. And read it for 3 days.
Let's talk about, following on with the reveals of the names.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the reveals that she does. Obviously, we've talked about Joe's reveal.
Yes.
Which is...
Loved it.
So exciting. I think one of my favourite big reveals was the idea that Peter Duke had gone to visit the farm unbeknownst to Nelson, Joe, and obviously not to Lara at that point, and pays them a huge amount of money for this little plot under a tree in the cemetery where until then only family have ever been buried. And that is what enables them to leave the farm. And I found that strangely moving, that first of all, he had had one afternoon at that farm when the four of them went and was so, we talked about it earlier, this farm was obviously the epitome of what everyone felt, their family life with the farmhouse and the, you know, the lovely kind of the napkins and the crockery and all this sort of this beautiful domestic scene. It was tough, it was hard, they didn't have a lot of money, but everything felt just like it should.
Yeah.
And then the land and all he wanted to do, even at that point, as a sort of film star, still wanted to come back and that would be where he would rest.
Yeah.
And I didn't find that unbelievable, that scenario, that he would have felt like that, because he was such a troubled soul who clearly didn't have a feeling of home himself. Did you feel that reveal was plausible?
Yeah, I did actually. I liked that Sebastian made a reappearance, for sure. But no, I thought it was a good way to sort of wrap the book up.
Tie up some loose ends.
Yeah.
But neatly.
Yeah, and I liked the way it was sort of held back till the end. And his death as well, because we were debating yesterday, we couldn't remember exactly when it becomes apparent that Duke has died. I was always under the impression that maybe he has, but it wasn't sort of explicitly said until a bit later on in the book. But maybe that, I don't know, maybe that was just me. Did you have any inkling he was dead from the off?
No. You know, reading a book, we all see different things, don't we? And to me, that message was, yeah, that sort of, that those people that are very successful and very driven and very troubled, you know, and they achieve everything that we all, you know, on paper think is the markers of a successful life, you know, being a movie star, yeah, or any of that. And actually, fundamentally, he just wants to rest under a cherry tree in Michigan. You know, and I thought that was really moving. And I thought that tells you a lot about what we all, you know, will probably feel when we're on our deathbeds is not, oh, I wish that I had
released 5 more feature movies.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, but what, you know, or whatever, or like, yeah, been, you know, it's actually, God, I wish I'd spent more time in places that made me happy, yeah, with people that make me happy.
Yeah.
You know, and that really resonates to me now. It's just a, you know, just trying to work out what, you know, that juggle of, yeah, like, you know, and actually fundamentally, I just want to go and I really want to go to Michigan now, which I've never done before, never wanted to do before. But no, but you know, like that thing of like, Mary made me think about how actually the highlights of my life are times sitting on the beach in Cornwall, or do you know what I mean? Or, you know, like with my family, and those are the, you know, it sort of redefines what success is. And I think that's a theme that a lot of people are exploring right now, yeah, you know?
Well, and I think linking back to this book being set in the pandemic, it's that idea of actually simple, basic. I mean, yeah, when we all had our hour a day of being allowed out right at the beginning of very strict lockdown, oh my God, did I appreciate walking around the common, yeah, in circles, I mean, like, endlessly.
I would have given anything to have been on a cherry farm in Michigan.
I know, and, yeah,
and not my tiny 2-bed terraced house in, yes, South London.
But even getting out, yeah, and knowing that, yeah, you could go out, suddenly having that moment of being out in the park or wherever you might have been in the world became so... It was like medicine for the soul. It was so soothing to suddenly be outside and something. And actually being at home surrounded by tech and 24-hour news and all that other stuff, you didn't need any of it. You just, well, for me personally, I felt like I really enjoyed being just, you know, and I kind of miss my family walks.
Yeah. I also we think did. there was a weird safety in it where we, you know, like I especially think about that first lockdown when the weather was beautiful and, you know, obviously it was a devastating experience for many, many people. But I think for a lot of people, there was also this kind of sense of like, we're all trudging along constantly and trying to like, what am I heading to next? What am I heading, yeah, to next? What have I got to do now? What have I got to do now to be, you know, to be successful, to reach whichever pillar? And then there was this like, everything stopped. It was like, actually, everything has stopped. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this feels actually... I mean, this is... I'm talking from my own personal experience. Yeah. I was like, whew.
Let's catch our breath.
Let's catch our breath, yeah, and what matters, yeah, you know? And I think that, you know, however horrible it may have been, I think it was certainly a very important pause for, you know, a lot of people I know who left London, you know? Or they... got divorced, or that, you know, they went, actually, I don't want to do this job anymore. This job sucks. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I want to go and be a seamstress, you know, or whatever. But like, and I think that it also really explores that really well.
Yeah,
and, you know, about where our priorities lie and whether, you know, in late capitalism, whether that's necessarily, you know, we're, yeah, all starting to question it and go, hang on, I don't know if I want to be on this constant trudge to make more money and be more, you know, more.
Yeah, consume
like,
more. And,
what if this is, yeah, just enough?
Yeah. And Laura does explore that even with the cherries. Can you remember there's that one bit where she was like, oh, a sort of wholesaler said they wanted plums. So he like...
Yeah. But it's like that.
Planted plum trees and did it, and then we did all this and this and this, and then they were like, actually, no, we don't want the plums anymore, and it completely screwed them
well,
over.
Well, the ability as well for, like, society now, yeah, for, yeah, like, capitalist society, yeah, like, very, like, right on or whatever, but, like, to take the joy out of even this sort, yeah, of the natural,
yeah,
things,
yeah,
in society.
Beautiful plants.
And it's,
yeah,
a bit like,
do any of us actually enjoy this?
Yeah.
You know, so we're all looking around at each other going, what are we doing?
Yeah. I think also in the novel, she writes quite sensitively about the fact through Lara that the pandemic was a horrendous experience for a lot of people for many different reasons all around the world. But in her experience, she is explaining how it did give her, it's given them as a family this pause and this moment together where she's got three grown-up daughters all well into their 20s at home with her. So she acknowledges that there's difficulties, but then she sort of turns to the point that, what was it, that's something about, and the grass is still kind of wet and muddy and dewy and the cherries are still going from tart to sweet and like nature is still continuing and life does still go on and we are here in this moment and she is relishing it.
I feel like
Still also appreciating there is great sadness and tragedy going on in the world, but she feels like the happiness and the sadness can coexist.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really hard sometimes, you know, as humans and as mothers as well, I think sometimes to feel like I can be really happy about this and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that she does do that really well, especially when it comes to the difficulty she experiences with Emily, her daughter in the teenage years. You know, she obviously loves her, but at the same time is completely frustrated with her. And they're barely talking at some points in that time. And I feel like she just does that really nicely when she's talking about the pandemic and about that relationship.
Yeah, and I think by the end of the book, like, some necessary healing has definitely happened between her and Emily and therefore the rest of the household when it comes to sort of talking about Duke and Emily finally accepting that he, you know, her mum did the right thing for her and that Duke isn't her father and Joe's actually all right, really, and all that stuff. But I do think she's quite good at sort of touching on the guilt she feels about having these precious moments and trying to sort of respect the fact that apart from Emily, the other two daughters, one's training to be a vet and the other wants to be an actress, and they're having these things sort of taken away from them, their progress and things, but she's sort of secretly relishing what we were just saying about how wonderful it is to have her three daughters all under one roof working together. Motherhood, I thought, I'm not a mother, but for me, when I was reading the whole thing, it really did feel like a key theme. You know, there's Lara who's living with her grandma. She's got her own sort of, it's revealed later on that her own mother had her quite late on in life and was almost sort of embarrassed to be a new mother when she had two sort of sons who were on the varsity football team. And then that's why she went to go and live with her grandmother. And then there's also, you know, the fact that they're all living under one roof for the first time in a long time. And then there's also sort of, for me, like the themes about in our town as well, you know, Emily, the character in the play, dies during childbirth. And then there's the other sort of
Emily, the real Emily.
The real Emily,
Wanting, deciding that she's not going to have children.
Exactly, and really rocking the boat, which can happen a lot of times. I think lots of parents can feel very saddened if they hear that their own child doesn't want to necessarily have children themselves. Yeah, I was just wondering, I guess you two are both mothers, did you sort of feel that theme quite strongly throughout the book?
Well, I also thought there's that sense of that they are our children, but they're their own humans.
Yeah.
They're not ours, actually. We're just privileged to have like brought them into the universe, and we look after them until they're 18, but they're their own humans and they're going to do what they want to do. And they, you know, that might be they're gonna, you know, become deluded that, you know, that George Clooney's their dad. I can't wait for my daughter to get to that stage.
Yeah, you'd be like,
well, actually
keep that rumor going.
Or, you know, and then they'll be like, well, I'm deciding not to have children. And you're like, well, just as they think they know the better versions of their mother's story, parents think they have better versions of their children's story.
Oh my God, that's so true.
And it's not, and that isn't the case. You know, we are all just humans. And I think that's fundamentally what the kind of theme is for me, is that, right, really going, ooh, like, I don't, you know, I have this idea of my mother as my mother, and she has this idea of me as her daughter. But there's also these versions of us that are in many ways just the real versions of us who are whole humans.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's a really important thing for me in parenthood as well. Personally, it's like, it is not my job to, like, this child, this human's job is not to please me. Mm. It is not, you know, this human's job is
to... Disappointing that, though, isn't
it? I know,
but I mean, this I feel really like... This, no one told me that before.
This yeah. human's job is to be themselves, and my job is to let them know that the person they are is fucking brilliant,
yeah.
even if at times that person is difficult. Because actually... You know, that is what life is, you know, and it's about letting them accept themselves for all of themselves, and the tricky bits yeah. as well as the kind of joyous bits. You know, that's the that I think is the absolute, like, that's the point of parenthood, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I think actually the grandma gets that.
Oh, she's great.
She lets her go and do her thing.
Yeah.
And kind of sends her off with four dresses to wish her good luck on the way.
Yeah.
And I feel like that, to me, that felt like one of the health... I mean, I feel like actually Lara has a really quite strong, healthy relationship with all her daughters. And complete hats yeah. off to that. It's an amazing family community. And the fact that Jo...
hats off to her. It's like, she's not real.
But to me, she is. And also that Jo has... I mean, thinking with the motherhood, but also like fatherhood. Jo, this silent, constant... lovely, warm, giving, hardworking.
Yeah, that's, but just yeah. you know, like, let's not put like loads of plaudits on Jo, because oh Jo, like this is such a thing. I'm like, oh, Joe's so nice because he puts up with all of these women in his life. No, no,
no, no, not, no. I'm not saying he's putting up
no,
with.
No, no, that's probably my mum's voice coming in. But like that thing no, where I we know, go, oh look,
well
this is
the man.
Hardworking man who's yeah. a good dad. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, shall we give him a fucking medal because he's not being a dickhead like Peter Duke? Like, no, like, let's just acknowledge Joe does a good job as he should.
Yeah, okay, fair. Okay, let's take a moment then to think about the men in the book.
Yeah, the men in the book.
Obviously, before we...
Oh, fuck the men.
Sebastian.
Yes.
The one that got away. I mean, could have been.
He was
definitely
billed.
Felt like it could have been when they were sitting in the restaurant after yeah. she has had sex in the bathroom with his brother.
Yeah, but it felt like a conscious choice on her part to not make that go any further.
I mean, I don't think he would have done that to his brother, though, would he? He
but
wouldn't
it seemed
have got
like
together.
She thought something could happen if she decided to.
And Joe says to her,
"Yeah,
in the book,
yeah."
Were you in love with him? Talking
yeah.
about Sebastian. So it, clearly yeah. there was something there that even yeah. he noticed
yeah.
back in Tom Lake and had, you know, thought that, yeah, would that develop? Is there a spark or something? Which obviously it doesn't.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But I just wondered whether you wanted it to. Would you have seen as that as a...
No, I wouldn't have done. I
no, you got. I just think it's really great for there to be relationships between men and women that
yeah.
aren't like loaded with sex.
Yeah, agree. I liked the dynamic of the four of them. It felt very realistic, and it felt what I liked.
Well, the
about
four being Palace,
Sebastian,
Lara. Palace and Sebastian and Lara and Peter
yes.
and that kind of few weeks where he was
yeah.
coming up every weekend
yeah.
from his tennis coaching
yeah.
and they were hanging out.
Yeah, but like those Tom Lake scenes felt very realistic. Like I think, I'm not a theatre kid, but it all felt very realistic as to like, I liked the scenes where they were like, this is the discipline, you get up, you do this. Well, in their case, you get up, have sex, don't do breakfast, go into rehearsals all day, go for a swim in the lake. Do this, do that. And it was all very regimented. And I can see, like, in those situations why relationships would form, like, very quickly and intensely.
Yeah, everything's, like, speeded up, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and she kept saying, didn't she, like, oh, in Tom Lake time, like, 4 days feels like 6 months sort of thing. So I liked the four of them. I liked Palace as a character as well. I thought she was really interesting. Mm. I liked the descriptions of her in the cabaret rehearsals. I thought she, yeah... She seemed a really interesting character. I know technically she sort of betrayed Lara later on when then she started having the affair with Duke. But I don't know, there was something about the four of them. It did almost feel, not fluid, but it did kind of feel
also,
as though
but also there's all
anything
that
goes.
Like, but also that that whole like other thing of like understudies.
Yes.
And I thought that's just like, it is that flow of life. It's like sometimes you're on top and sometimes you're not. And it's not really a reflection of how good you are. Or it's just
luck and timing.
Luck and timing. Sometimes you're the understudy and sometimes you're the main star.
Exactly. And all you need is an accident on the tennis court and then your time will come.
Like luck and timing.
I think that... But there's a sort of vulnerability, isn't there, where, you know, Peter, he's just sort of like, right, she's, you know, Lara's come in, I'm honing in on her. Oh, actually, she's not up to the next play. Right, the understudy's coming in. Okay, now I'm honing in on her.
Well, I mean, it's
there
just
was
like
a sort of real predatory element to that whole scenario.
I mean, we've all met.
Uncomfortable.
We've all had, I mean, I've certainly had men in my life like that, you know. Of that ilk as well. I mean, like Peter Duke, I was like, my clothes fell off, obviously, at the beginning, but soon I was like...
Should we chat about that a bit? Because, obviously he is this heartthrob, and like to many people just watching his films, he's clearly
captivating. He's a tragic human being.
Exactly.
And the girls watching, I mean, these young girls, the daughters, have grown up watching him in movies. Yeah. So he was obviously in some kind of family-friendly movies. And they adore him. And obviously she's watching it through a completely different lens. And why, when you get to the end of the novel and you realise...
It's all smoke and mirrors.
And how awful their last encounter was. On so many levels. That you then... I just think, God, how could she even have managed to have those movies playing in her house? I think I would have... I mean, it could have been a VHS or a Betamax that time, but she's chucking them. I would have chucked them away. There's no way. But she somehow manages to separate herself quite well and allows them to... Because once you know the full story, how she must have sat with Emily going on and on about him being her dad, how amazing he was. I mean, that must have just been... so horrendous, as opposed to, oh yeah, there's a guy I once had a lovely romance.
But this is again, everyone has their own versions. And also, like, that's the thing. It's that thing of she feels one way about Peter Duke, but he, you know, he will have seen it in a different, you know, we all, like someone said, there's three versions of the truth. There's your version, there's my version, and then there's the truth.
And I suppose she had made some peace with it because actually... To correct myself, the last time she saw him wasn't at the mental hospital. It was actually
when he came
to the farm, and she's there with like all the sort of scruffy little toe rags around her, feeling very dishevelled, and he appears all kind of shiny and clean, and she's like not.
Who's got the better life?
Well, exactly. But as in, so she's happy and contented, and I suppose that's... So maybe she made her peace with it then, knowing...
Perhaps, you
know, so therefore she was then able to stomach her kids watching it and adoring him as a movie star.
Yeah, I never really thought about it in that way, having thought about, how it all ends.
It's just another role, isn't it?
I did find that really interesting, what you were just saying about your version, this version, the truth. Because actually, when she goes to visit him in hospital, you almost see him, or she almost sees him, with a different pair of eyes, because he's not really that bothered about her. It's very clear he's just like, who's the one person I could call right now who would come and have sex with me in the bathroom? Oh yeah, that girl from a few years ago. Who you can tell in those moments, I think, how little she meant to him at the time when they were at Tom Lake. Like, it was just another fling for him, perhaps, in a way that, because it's all sort of told from Lara's perspective, he obviously meant a lot more to her than vice versa. Or that's the kind of impression I got anyway.
Well, the fact that he wanted to be buried though, in but also it's that romanticizing things in our heads, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, perhaps he was in love with that.
But he didn't know she was living there, did he, when he bought the piece of land? He had no idea that she was gonna end up being there. So I don't think he associated the farm with her.
No, but I mean, he would have... But that farm, he would have associated with that period of time.
So also, I think the emphasis on this whole book and the story she's telling is this part in her life as Peter Duke and that relationship. What she doesn't talk about, and what her daughters obviously don't ask her about, because it's not as sexy and cool and romantic and amazing, is how she, what really happened when she met her, their father,
yeah,
and what really happened in that romance, which clearly is the defining romance of her life.
Yeah.
So I think it's not that maybe she meant nothing to Peter Duke and he called her up as this girl from years ago where he meant everything to her. It's more just that the bit of her life that her children want to know about,
yeah,
is that romance. Mm. But of course, the biggest romance in her life is falling in love with Joe.
Yeah.
But she's quite protective about that somehow. Yeah. I feel like she, I mean, they're not asking her about it, but I feel even when he starts coming into the story, it's kept quite small.
Yeah, I think there's a line she says with that particular part where she's like, oh, they're not interested. But I think it's something along the lines of like, you know, no one's interested in the sort of boring, quiet love. They're only like interested in the messy affairs. So I guess maybe that's why she doesn't but go what into is, it too but much.
That what is the real?
Yeah.
The real thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
It is the Joe. It is the, it's not the person we think it's going to be. It isn't the movie star. It isn't the kind of like, it's never, I mean, it's, in my experience, it isn't the fireworks.
Yeah.
It isn't the, like, in a way, they're the sign of something being wrong.
Yeah,
with some,
the bad
you know,
boy.
That's like, that is actually, it's like my wounded child recognizing someone else's wounded child.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, like, the great love story of my life has been with my very boring husband, do you know what I mean? Who, over many years, we've, you know, like, but we've kind of bump along and we've been through shit together and we've stuck with each other and, you know, and he kind of quietly came in and I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Slipped in anyway.
Where did you come from? How are we married?
So there was one lovely line towards the end of the book where Lara tells the reader, so not the girls, but saying, the past need not be so all-encompassing that it renders us incapable of making an egg salad. So Lara obviously keeps some secrets to herself. And I really loved the way it was written between, again, at the beginning, when you're starting reading, you're like, is she telling us, like, who's interrupting her right now? And it takes a while to kind of get into the rhythm of the fact that she's telling it all herself, but sometimes it's to the girls, sometimes Joe's there, but sometimes she's just telling us. Lara obviously has some secrets. If you had to retell your own story, would you airbrush some of your past if you were speaking to your children?
Oh, yes. Most certainly.
100% yes. I mean, yes. Yes, I do. I think also there's always keep your powder dry. You know, if I have one of my children when they're about 30 or 40 and I'm the age I am at that point and they kind of go, oh my God, this thing's happened to me. I'd love to be able to pull an anecdote out that they haven't heard before and say, oh, well, actually, you're not alone. Because once this happened to me and I haven't told you about it and let's now. And then suddenly I feel like you've just got a little bit more. You don't have to sort of drop everything in their lap straight away.
Yeah.
I think, the age appropriate stuff as well. I obviously wrestle with this all the time as someone who writes about like my own experiences. And, you know, I think there's ways of approaching serious subjects where you don't have to like, you know, you don't have to give everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. That feels like a really nice way to get into having a chat about your new book, Mad Woman. It is book number
8.
Amazing. Yeah. That is incredible.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I'm just going to take that. Thank you.
It really is. Yeah, there's no buts. There's just, thank you.
Yeah, no, that instinctive thing of going, oh, a little old me. I'm like, no, fuck it. Yeah, I am great.
Yeah.
And we love the cover. Clearly, it's gorgeous. But also the contents. So it's set out. You tell us how it's set out because it's not just words on a page, is it?
Well, it's a kind of follow-up to a book I wrote 10 years ago called Mad Girl, which was all about my experiences with obsessive-compulsive disorder and eating disorders. And it was really, you know, it did very well. And it really led me into this quite sort of unexpected life as a kind of mental health campaigner and, you know, going with the flow, all of that. And I've, you know, in the intervening decade have learned quite a lot about myself. I've got sober. I've explored lots of things. And you know, you kind of constantly think that you've done the work, so you should be better. And then obviously, you know, that isn't the case. And in the pandemic, I thought I was totally fine and I wasn't. And, you know, I sort of became mentally unwell, but I kind of feel I had to, and I learned quite a lot about myself through that process. And so whereas Mad Girl kind of follows the first like 33 decades of my life, Mad Woman is kind of the last 3 years. And it's really about that experience of realizing actually that a lot of the stuff that, you know, that the mad woman isn't, it's kind of going, well, actually a lot of stuff that we, you know, it goes back to that thing of being called hysterical or whatever, but a lot of the stuff that has happened in my life, a lot of the mental illness has been really appropriate. And a lot of, as women, I think a lot of our experiences are appropriate to living in a society that isn't really set up for us. So the bad, the kind of like depression, anxiety, eating disorders, all of that, I think are a direct, you know, direct result of living in a society that tells you you need to be this, you need to be that, and isn't sort of set up for you. So I kind of wanted to explore that. Because having thought I was like relatively sorted, I was really kind of polaxed in end of 2020, where I realized I had developed a different eating disorder, a binge eating disorder, which I didn't even really know knew existed. And then, you know, I've had OCD since childhood, but it came back very, very badly, shortly afterwards. And I was really kind of thrown by it because I didn't see it coming, and I was sober and all of these things. And, you know, it turned out I was very hormonal. It turned out I've gone through quite an early menopause, and it was discovering all the links, like the huge links between hormones and mental health, and how I had probably had PMDD, premenstrual dysphoria disorder, since I was like 12. But, you know, no one bothers, you know, it's like these are conditions that we're only starting to really explore now. Endometriosis, stuff that has existed since the dawn of fucking time, do you know what I mean?
But because it's a women's health issue,
no one's bothered. How we are kind of going into that now. So it's really like the mad woman in this book is me going, I am fucking mad, and I'm mad at the way that I, you know, that I've been made to think I'm a problem the whole time. I'm not a problem. I'm a normal human being reacting appropriately to this fucked up world we live in. So that's really what it's about. In a nutshell, that was not a nutshell. You know, spoiler alert, I end up at the end sitting on this sofa with you guys talking about Tom Lake. So, like, nothing too bad happens. But
I liked that there were loads of screen grabs throughout of, like, notes that you'd written, say, at the beginning of 2020 or end of 2019 and things. I thought that was really effective.
The notes.
Like, showing. Even notes from your daughter as well, with six-year-old spellings, which
I loved. The iPhone notes. Yeah. Well, yeah, and they were all, they're all, like, real, like, I had gone through my notes on my iPhone. So when I sent this book in, it was just like a straight memoir. And they were like, the thing is, Bryony, memoir has changed since you last had a book out. And, you know, people can't concentrate quite as much. So
we need to
break it up a bit. And
I was like, what?
And I was like, oh, I know. So I had this idea of, like showing little snapshots from the notes app on my iPhone at various points through the book, which sort of, I think, chart exactly the kind of spiral and descent. So they start off really like, woo, you know, you don't need to make New Year's resolutions. You're an amazing human being and you've got this. And they sort of slowly descend into just like links to sweaty Betty leggings. And then, you know, and then it's just complete like, oh my God. You know, I don't know how I'm gonna, you know, get through the next day, which was very much my experience for quite, you know, a long period.
Well, I'm halfway through. I'm completely gripped. It's such a fantastic exploration of all those issues you're talking about. And I think that there aren't enough voices kind of making it safe for people to talk about it in a way that not normalizes it, but in a way that takes the stigma away, because sadly, I think there's still too much stigma around people talking about mental health and how they feel, and being able to, especially if you're in the workplace or wanting to be able to talk about things you're going through, it's very difficult. It's one thing with a friend over a cup of tea, but actually to go out into the world and put it all out there is not easy.
But it is also, for me, it's like, it's how I've come to see that that's what my job is now, you know? Yeah. It's like, this stuff has happened to me, and for some reason I don't feel that much like anxiety about putting it out there. In fact, I almost like feel this need to do it, because what I get out of it is this huge connection with other people who, like, every book I've written has been like, I went through this thing and I felt really ashamed of it, or I felt a lot of shame, but now I've come through it and I've realized that there's lots of people out there who go through these things. And, you know, it's writing it down and going, read this and please know that you don't have to feel this shame, and it's okay, and there is life on the other side. And that's what every book has been for me, really. Yeah, so it's important to me. And I think that, you know, we have this notion that mental health is, or mental illness is something that we've sort of dealt with in society, and because lots of people talk about it. And I'm like, but it hasn't really been. And there's still a long way to go in terms of, you know, we still don't treat people with mental illness in the same way that we treat people with physical illness. We just don't. And we've got a long way to go. And so I just will keep banging the drum, you know, be it through my experiences. You know, fortunately at the moment I'm feeling great. I'm feeling, you know, but there's always some, you know, there's like, life is life.
Okay,
you know?
It is an ongoing process, isn't it? Anything like that. Like it, I suppose you just have.
It's not like, oh, I'm healed now, tick.
Yeah.
What should I do next?
Yeah.
And that's what I think, you know, books have to have like neat beginnings, middles and ends, but life doesn't,
no,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like when the two collide, it's like, well, you know, right, like this is, oh, here's another lesson. Here's another thing I need to let go of or learn, you know? And the universe will keep giving me this lesson until I really do learn it.
Well, I wouldn't want to say, I hope you never learn it because we want to read more books from you, because that would feel a bit crass. It's a great book and I highly recommend it to everybody listening. So thank you. And thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like there's so many more bits to the Tom Lake we could have gone and talked about, but time is time. And so we have to.
Luck and timing.
Yes, luck and
there.
Timing. Spoilers.
So thank you, everybody, for listening, for commenting on the community. Thank you, Bryony, for coming in today. So thank you so much for watching and listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and tell your friends. And we'll see you next time.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.